Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00041. Recorded on April 19, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Soul Suck. Soul Suck. Chapter 41.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
A few weeks ago, I had mentioned about the very unpleasant transition our seasons are going through, moving away from winter and into summer, this intermittent period that some refer to as spring. And I say it like that because here in Post-Harlan, Texas, we frequently don't have very much of a spring. It could be a couple of weeks. It's, like I said, a transitional season, and the transition can happen in the course of a day or a month or two, you know. The month or two would be a spring, but that's not really all that common. And of course, you know, a normal spring in a temperate climate would be a full 3 months. We just don't do that here. It just doesn't happen. But it's been kind of working towards a temperate spring this year so far. Temperatures routinely on a daily basis are in the 70s, which is very nice, obviously. And it's been that way for weeks. We've got up into the 90s once or twice, into the 80s a handful of times, but generally around the 70s, you know. And it has not been as stormy of a spring as we normally get. Of course, we got some time to go before the tornado season ends, right? Regardless of how long spring may or may not be in DFW in a given year, the tornado season goes all the way out to the calendar spring ending in June, right? But well, I say all this to say, I had mentioned about the ugly transition that we're going through, the proliferation of a whole wide assortment of very ugly weeds growing up and dormant and burnt out lawns that just don't seem to want to be coming back, you know. And in a lot of cases, in my cases anyway, you know, the shit that I gotta look at on the job and at home, I've spoke at some length, I guess, through these episodes about how my lawn got burnt out and burnt up in our mini drought last year. Sadly, but here on the job, I think, you know, the we've got like 8 different grasses that make up the quote-unquote lawn here, you know, on this commercial property. I think probably 30 years ago they slapped down Bermuda grass, which is common grass in the South, right? 2 common southern grasses that you're going to see in climate zones like 7, 8, 9 are going to be Bermuda grass and St. Augustine's, right? Like St. Augustine, Florida, like St. Augustine, the actual saint, right? St. Augustine of Hippo, if you know your Christian history. Those are the 2 kind of common grasses in the South. We had the St. Augustine's on our property at the house. Nice grass, really good grass. Grows laterally, horizontally on runners. It's a little different. If you're from up north or from elsewhere in the world, you might not even know that grass does this sort of thing. But this actually grows like a vine across the ground horizontally. And then, you know, every couple inches or so digs down into the dirt and holds the vine in place. And then the blades of grass grow out the vine. And it's lush. The very thick blades. They grow stout. You can actually let that grow tall and cut it high, have a deep carpet, and you can kind of cut it low too if you want, you know. But it's a good grass, St. Augustine's. Here on the job, we don't have that. It looks like they try, like I said, like 30 years ago or more, they may have sodded the place with Bermuda grass, but all the native grasses have since taken it over, and you've got this mix going on. And there is still, like, the main grass is still dormant. You got this brown, dead-looking shit, and then you got this variety of different prairie grasses growing up. They're green. And then you got all the weeds growing up, and they're green, too. And it's still ugly. It's not as ugly as it was a couple of weeks ago, but it's still ugly. My yard is ugly because all the grass is dead. And, well, I made a decision. You know, I'm just sick of looking at all this ugly. I wasn't really planning on doing a whole lot of outside yard work this year. Little patch-ups here and there, finish off some of the disasters that beset us, you know, between the drought and that fucking tree rotting out and dying and landing on the shed and, you know. Because of all that, I kind of just shrugged my shoulders and say, you know, 2023, I don't want to spend time out in the fucking yard. I need to get a life and go, I get out and do some things, you know. But no, I guess I really don't. I really need to take care of some business. So I made the decision that I'm going to work at just completely restoring. I don't know if restoring, renewing is probably a better word. Renewing the entire fucking domestic property. So I'm doing landscape planning, right? Shit that I have not really involved myself in since my days in Tennessee ended. And we're going back now. See, how long has it been? 7 years since I left there? Yup, 7 years plus, a couple months. Well, more than that, actually. Like 7.5 years. Since I left there, and before I moved there, I was here in DFW, and I did a bunch of landscape type of shit around the house. So those days, it would be 2012, 13, 14, 15. I was doing a lot of stuff. After that, not so much. A bunch of those years, I was kind of living couch to couch. I didn't have land to scape, you know. Here I do, and because the lawn died, I got to do something with it. It's just ugly, and it ain't going to change unless I step up. So stepping up is what I'm doing, and I'm looking at everything from a new lawn to new trees and new shrubs, edging and mulching and laying down rock perimeters and all kinds. Just, you know, I was just going to focus on the backyard originally because that's where we had all the trials and tribulations in the fall last year. And that's really actually where the idea kind of cropped up. I'm looking at it like, you know, all this shit happened and here's what we're left with. I could just fight the tide and put up a whole new lawn and just let it be. Or I could kind of work with what we got, you know. And what I mean by that is, well, I got a dead lawn. So now I got a head start in actually taking the lawn up. Why would you want to take a lawn up? Well, if you were going to do a nice sized garden, for example, you're going to do an outbuilding, right? Another shed, something. Yeah, you want to get rid of the fucking lawn under it. And, you know, you don't want that shit like growing up or rotting under it or anything like that. So I would have had to take it up to accomplish these things. So let's just say that Mother Nature did that for me. So let's just kind of go with the flow, roll with the punches instead of fighting against the tide. And that's what I'm fixing to do. You know, I decided in the backyard, I'm going to do something about some kind of outbuilding. And I want to do a chicken coop and get a couple of hens. And I want to put up some kind of garden on the ground, right? Those are the projects I got for the summer lined up for the backyard. And before I even took a step in that direction, I said to myself, you know what? Let's do the front. Let's just fucking do the front, make the front nice. First. So now I'm going to end up doing the whole yard this whole year. I'm not going to have a weekend to do fucking anything. And life goes on. It's called being a man. You know, it happens. I should have been in this predicament, you know, 25 years ago. And now I should be settling into a nice cozy household where all I got to do is a little maintenance every here and there. And, you know, landscaping would equate to my wife buying some flowers and sticking them in a fucking pot somewhere. You know, and that would be the end of it. But no. Nope. You start over from scratch when you live like a rolling stone, right? Which I have. And if you know me, you know that. So, I've been doing a lot of shopping, mostly online, for trees and shrubs and things like that that are not generally my forte. I don't know all about that sort of thing, you know. I do know that I do well working dirt, doing landscapes. I just got a knack for it. I think it may just be in the family blood. I think, yeah, we have a heritage of being like kind of Cossack farmers out of the Ukraine on the one side of the family, and I think it holds true for all of us. I think we all natural with the fucking shovel, making things happen, right? I personally have a strength in that regard. I do well with this sort of thing. And though I will get frustrated while I'm in the middle of the project working it, I get a lot of satisfaction every night. When you know, after the day's work, it's really good work for the soul. And, you know, if I do well with it and things kind of fall into place, it's going to have a lasting effect in that regard as the seasons go by, as the years go by. So a lot of tree and shrub shopping. I decided we're going to plant an ornamental tree in the front yard, right? Or a little tiny front yard. Basically has two sections around the walkway that runs up to the door, right? From the street to the door, you got a little concrete sidewalk. And then on each side of it, patch of grass. One side, you know, to the left, a little larger than the one to the right. And I'm thinking on the larger side, just right plunk down in the middle of it all. And I measured it out to the fucking inch, you know. We're going to plant some kind of ornamental tree. Ornamental is going to have to fit in with the situation. It's got to be small, you know. I want it to be big enough to throw shade on that front yard. And I want it to be short enough that it's not going to, like, grow over or into the house. So, an ornamental, you know, it's about looks. It's not about fruit or anything like that. I want it to help the neighborhood look better. It's basically my gift to the neighbors, what I'm doing out front, making the neighborhood a better place. I settled on a tree that's called the Forest Pansy Redbud, right? It's kind of a little bit of a smaller redbud tree. When it's matured out, it should be about 25 foot up and 25 foot around, which makes it good for the space that I'm throwing. Actually, it's going to be a little too big for that space. I probably won't live to see it get to that size, you know. Won't be an issue, but you can, you know, cut it back too. 25 foot in height won't be too bad. That's probably close to, you know, it's a one-story little house. It's probably close to matching the roof line at the peak. And as far as the yard coverage, you know, I want to get it out to the sidewalk and out to the house, but without going out over either of them generally. It should be decent. Now, what I like about the tree, its ornamental quality of it, is it's always a color, except in the winter. You know, it goes in a dormant month. It sheds its leaves, but it's like when the tree starts to come back, the first thing it does is flower. It blooms like bright pink, glowing fucking flowers. They all start dropping off. Then the leaves come up. When the leaves come up, they come up red, like a deep burgundy. And the leaves are shaped a little, well, not a little, but pretty sizable hearts. You know, maybe about the size of a baseball, right? And the more sun that these leaves take through the year, the more red the leaves stay. So now you've got ornamentally colored foliage plunked down in the middle of the neighborhood on the city block, right? If it happens to be a shady type of year for whatever reason, not a lot of sun, which ain't gonna happen, those leaves will start to tend more towards a kind of a dull, flat, greenish color. But will still retain like redness, like red veins and shit like that. Or you'll get a combination of leaves that are both red and green on the same tree, on the same branch. So you're always going to have some kind of color. And then it's supposed to go absolutely crazy come autumn when the trees start dropping. It's a tree of many, many colors, like all the reds and all the yellows and all the oranges and all the one tree will have all this variety of coloration. So it's a colorful tree, and it varies throughout the year. And, you know, sadly, it's not evergreen, so you're going to have that ugly season. You know, there will be 3 months out of the year where it's got nothing going for it. But that's the tree I decided on, the forest pansy redbud. And I got that thing stand. I ordered one up online, right? Because, like I said, a lot of shopping I've been doing for this stuff has been online. It's not like a unique tree or anything like that, but you're not going to go down to your box store, Home Depot, or Tractor Supply, or Lowe's, or whatever, and just find it sitting out there, you know? Have to go to a nursery somewhere along the way and have it shipped in. And I did that, and it worked out. $200 fucking. You know, I bought a 7 foot tree, which is the maximum size that I was able to find. So you pay the maximum price. The price was actually like $175, and then you had a shipping cost on top of it. Or tax. Actually, no shipping, but the taxes put it up around $200, right? The shipping was free, thankfully. So it still ends up being, out of my pocket, a $200 tree. And, yeah, it's a Charlie Brown fucking Christmas tree. It's just, it's one, yeah, it's a 7 foot long twig with a couple of 1 foot twigs sticking out of it and like 8 leaves on it. That's all there is to it. I don't know how many years it's going to take for that thing to even resemble an actual tree. You know, I think it's still shy of a fucking sapling at this point. It's probably like 3 or 4 years old to be as tall as it is. I'm a little concerned. Like, I planted it at the right time of the year, right? The spring was the right time to plant these things. And we have it in the ground, right? We got it. I dug out. I'll talk about this. But I had the hole dug up and waiting for the FedEx guy to drive up with the tree in a box. And got it right in the ground and everything. Fertilizer stick jammed in there, watering it. My wife, she'll come home and water it every single day. And well, my concern is, though, like I'm sitting here and I'm doing the this audio podcast in the F-150 mobile studio on my break at work, and it's been a windy 2 days, right? I'm watching all the newly grown leaves, and all the trees are blowing around madly, right? We got a good solid 20 mile an hour wind going yesterday and today. When the storms come, that wind can go up to 70, 80 on a front line, you know, on a front line of wind. And of course, you get a tornado, there's that. And you get hailstorms, they'll tear fucking trees to shreds. So I got this little fucking baby ass sapling sitting in the middle of my front yard right now, and it's right at the season for all this shit to come to it. We got a line of storms that are going to come through tomorrow. That's going to be the first test, you know. And it's going to endure without even having rooted down. It's a ball of roots and dirt, and they haven't grown out. Because there's no leaves on it, there's a chance it might not blow over. I don't know. But you know, I'm worried about this tree like I was worried about the Texas spiny lizard that I adopted, which I set free, by the way, for all you who are curious. I set it free in the backyard at my house, and I ain't seen it since, so I don't know what's become of it. But it was healthy, you know. Nursed it back to health, and it shot out in a hurry. Anyway, it's gone. But I have the same feeling about this tree that I had about the lizard, and the same feeling with the lizard that I had about my own dog. So it's like these living things that I take responsibility for. Now that it just weighs on my mind. I'm here on my job doing what I'm doing here, and I'm thinking about home, about this fucking tree sitting in my front yard, you know. What's going to happen with the wind? What's going to happen with the storms and the hail and all that shit, you know? Is this thing going to root up and take? Is it going to fucking get diseased? What do I do? You know, all that. But, you know, I got that far with all the online shopping to make a decision to get that tree. And when the tree doubles in size, triples in size, it'll be perfect for that space. It'll be a good little thing. I got to work the grounds under and around it now, and I've already kind of sized up a perimeter I'm going to build. I did a lot of work. It didn't get very far, you know. I busted my ass this past weekend and a little bit the weekend before. I'm putting a little rock border, like white marble rock border around the foundation. And it ends up being about 2 foot. You know, it's like 26, 27 inches, technically. It's going to end up all the way around the house, but I'm working the front and then the one side right now that's exposed, not fenced in. And we got a portion of that done. I got it contained with like a plastic border. Right. And it actually, you know, it has sharpened up the look of the house. I've already gotten compliments just on that alone. And that's something you won't even see when we're all done. I'm going to build a little white picket fence that sticks up in front of it. Right. So that'll be like a little pathway to walk around the house and do shit. Because I'm going to paint the house and put shutters up and all this fucking stuff, you know. Give me room to work there. We got a spigot in that area sticking up out of the front lawn, so we'll have access to that. You can hide a hose behind some shrubs, so I got to plant the shrubs. There's going to be a flower bed in front of this stuff, shrubs and flowers and ground cover, whatever. I haven't got that all sorted out. I'm still shopping that through. Well, you know, I've done a lot of the shopping, like I said, online, and I'm starting to look in stores at that stuff, the shrubs and flowers and everything, possibilities. But I'm not going out to the stores looking for that. I'm going out to the stores for all the other shit. Right? All the edging and all the stone and all the mulch and tools that, you know, some extra gardening tools that we may need, whatever. Whatever's on the list of shit to get. And while we're there, I'm kind of looking at it, you know. And it, what's sad is, like, when I would get into something like this, I know better than to wait till, like, the night, the first pretty day of spring to run down to the Home Depot or run to the nursery. Because that's what everybody's fucking doing, right? That's no different here. But this is exactly how it played out this year. I made the decision late in the game. Normally, the kind of stuff I'd be doing, or the kind of stuff I'm doing now, I would have been doing through the winter. And the only thing left to do would be like to set trees and shrubs and flowers into the ground, you know, when the weather's a little nicer. But everything would have been ready. All you gotta do is plant the shit, right? So we've been just light work left to do. Now I got everything. I got all the heavy work, everything. All the planting, all the heavy, everything. It's just all happening all at once. And I got Saturdays basically to do it, right? Because I work, you know, work a fucking day, Joe. At this work a fucking day job. I show up. Well, we go first. There's a pretty extensive nursery down in a city called Rowlett, Texas, right? Which is part of DFW over here, Post Arlen, Texas, as it's known. Down in Dallas County. And, well, like I said, they got a large nursery down there, which I've driven past on the road I don't know how many hundreds of times. But I always see it there, and I always make a note of it. And one day I'm going in there and see what they got. One day I'm going in there and see what they got. Well, the one day we drove out to there specifically, but it was a Saturday. You know, it was like in the late in the morning, and everybody was there. The fucking cars were pulling into the place, were backed out onto the roadway. Nowhere to park. We ended up stuck in that traffic just to get into the place, and we got in, and I made a decision. Let's not even get out. Don't even park. Fuck this. This is bedlam. You know, I don't want to. I got issues with dealing with fucking crowds of people. I'll get into that. I'll get into that as soon as I finish the rest of the story. The rest of the story is we ended up at the box store, Home Depot, and even Lowe's. We went to both of those. To just buy some of the shit that I needed. To look at what they had and make comparisons and do the math and all that. And so, you know, we ended up at the Home Depot. We passed through the Lowe's and didn't buy anything there. It always goes that way. I don't know. There's a difference between Home Depot and Lowe's. It's subtle, but it's there. They seem like the same store. One's orange and one's blue, but they sell kind of different shit. I think the Lowe's stuff is a little higher end. Perhaps. I never seem to buy anything there. I'm a bottom shelf guy. You know, I'll look at Lowe's and then I'll end up buying it at Home Depot. Sometimes I run over to the Tractor Supply, depending on what I'm looking for. But if I can avoid those box stores, I will, you know. But you know how it is. It's kind of hard to avoid that shit. We show up at the Home Depot on that same kind of Saturday where everybody's doing the same thing, and I end up in the fucking line. We go buy all this stuff. We, you know, a dozen 50-pound sacks or 70-pound sacks of marble to pour out. You know, so we got the big cart, and it's all fucking loaded down with all this weight. And buying, like, I don't know, what it was, 60 foot of edging material and extra spikes, and you know, we got five large bags of mulch and we got all this shit, right? And then go up in the line, and the people standing in the line, you know, that are making this day just that little bit more miserable for us, right? A long line of people, two long lines of people. Like the couple in front of us, they're buying like three bricks, two little marigold flowers, you know. And they might grab like a water out of the refrigerator while they're standing in line. And that's what they're doing there. That's their like urban sprawl day in the fucking garden, their yard work. And, you know, we got this humongous, complete fucking redo of our entire property at hand. And that's what it's like for people, you know. They're settled, and they just have little... You know, I think we could just use a little bit of red in that corner right there. And, you know, you get a red plant. But you're standing in the line at the Home Depot on the busiest fucking Home Depot day in the garden center of the fucking year, when everybody else has it in mind to do. I would normally know better than to do that. I would have been back there in February buying all this shit. I'd have been out in the yard digging up everything. And then I would have waited to plant stuff until the time was right for that. But nope, I got myself stuck in there, right? And that's the thing. It's like, I lost a day of work out in the yard because I spent the morning of the day shopping. I get around crowds, and you've heard me bitch about this sort of thing before in different with different backdrops, right? The problem with the crowds when we went to the big flea market, right, out in East Texas. I get the problem with the crowds wherever there's crowds. And I don't mean it to be like a psychological issue or anything like that. I don't mean it in that, like claustrophobic, although sometimes I get the feeling that way, a little claustrophobic. It's not a phobia thing. It's an introvert / extrovert thing. Let me explain that to you, right? You may have your own opinions on what makes an introvert an introvert, what makes an extrovert, and how you determine one from the other. Here's how I go with it, and I have done this for a very long time. Number one, right up front, understand, I recognize myself to be an introvert. That may seem contrary to anybody listening to a guy who could just sit down and talk for an hour at a microphone with no problem. I can chit-chat. I can do that. You know, I've become that kind of guy. I didn't used to be that kind of guy. It's something I had to work at. But whether I'm chit-chatting or not, whether I'm talking at all or not, I'm a fucking introvert. And the reason I'm an introvert is because the energy that I require to actually socialize with other people and to actually perform at any task is something that comes from my internals, right? I internally derive the energy for my get up and go in life. That's what an introvert does. It's an energy thing. Where on the other hand, an extrovert garnishes its energy off of other people's energy. They're like fucking vampires, right? Like a vampire, an extrovert needs people around, needs to be the center of attention, just needs attention all the time because they're drawing energy out of other people in order for them to accomplish their ends. It's vampirism on a spiritual level. I don't care what you fucking say. And it's not a choice that we make. We're one kind or the other, and that's that, you know? It's like your hair is brown and your eyes are green. You don't have a choice in the matter. I mean, yes, you could dye your hair and you can get fake contact lenses, and people do. But it's not the fucking point, all right? You are the way you are. I'm an introvert. Extroverts are vampires. You know, they're energy vampires. I always call them soul suckers. You know, when I get around people like that, I feel like the soul's getting sucked out of me. And why am I saying all this? I'm saying all this because I was shopping, and the idea of that day was to go shopping for an hour, pick up some things, get back to the house, and start getting cracking, you know, with the hard labor. Shopping didn't work out as planned. We ended up in multiple places. We finally got the shit that we got, but because there were so many people out doing the same thing, by the time I got back to the house, I was done. I was done. I did not have the energy to go on anymore. I needed to sit the fuck down and re-internalize everything in order to get the energy back up. And it just never really came around. It never came around that way. I don't like when that happens, you know, the part of myself that I don't like. The good thing is I don't need other people to get the energy back when it's been exhausted. But the bad thing is, it's so easily exhausted anymore. I go to church, right? We go to church. Our favorite thing to do. We go to church, you know. And church has even gotten better. I brought it up where I go serve at the altar, and it's kind of a mystical experience, and it just brought, like, worship to a whole nother fucking level, right? But being there has got me, we would get out of our liturgical services, which are a few hours, you know, it's not short. And then we would go socialize for another 2 or 3 hours afterwards. We do a big lunch thing, right? And just lately, you know, I go to church, and by the time the liturgy is over, I'm spent. I'm just done with people. More so when I've been serving at the altar, something that's a little bit more draining in that regard while I'm up there than it would be if I was out worshiping with the laity and the general area off of the altar. But I've been noticing just my sensitivity to people. You know, I don't go up and serve at the altar every single Sunday. I kind of mix it up a little bit because my wife is out there. We share the experience together. When I go up on the altar, she can't. And so I'll stand out there like I normally would, and I've just been noticing. I don't like being shoulder to shoulder with people, even people I like, you know? Even people who see the world with the same kind of glasses I'm looking through. It's just, I don't know. I just feel a draining, and that claustrophobic effect, actually. Our church has grown. I don't mean to go off on a tangent about that at all. That wasn't part of the plan to even talk about that thing. What I'm talking about, though, is introvert and extrovert energy, you know, based on energy. I just lost my ability to carry through with my plans one day because of it. Now, the day it didn't happen like that, the day I was able to get in and out of the store back, bam, I'm just busting it. Actually, I think I woke up one morning and just got right to it. Yeah. One day I didn't get it done, but I got the shopping done. The next day I got out in the fucking yard and started working. I busted it. I worked hard. I worked extremely hard. I think my wife was scared how hard I was going at it at certain parts. It just got to be that way. And you got these 50 or 60, whatever, these bags of stone that are heavy, lots of them, and you got to hump them from the fucking truck to where you're dumping them. And you got to bend them over and lift them up again when you're ready to cut them open and pour them out. It just adds up. It adds up quick. And then you got the shovel out and you're digging. And we're digging clay here. We're not digging nice topsoil dirt. It's all fucking clay right to the top. And it's heavy and it's sticky. And so every scoop of the shovel is a lot heavier than you would expect it to be. I'm using shovels that are from like the 50s. They actually have like metal handles, the dirt rake and the shovel, just these ancient fucking things, but they held up, but they weigh like easily 20 times more than a normal rake and a shovel would weigh. And I'm out there just slinging that shit around all fucking day. And, you know, just when I'm thinking, man, I'm getting too old for this shit, right? Then I run into this fucking evil sycamore tree root running across my front yard, right from the neighbor's yard. Neighbor's got a big sycamore tree. This fucking thing is like tilting down over the street, like over the power lines, over the street. I don't know how tall it is, 50, 60 foot up. It's a pretty big tree. I mean, it's definitely, it's been there. It's been there a long time, but it's falling over, right? It's leaning, it's growing, like at a, shit, I mean, I'm going to exaggerate, 45 degree angle. It ain't at a 90, it ain't quite 45, but it's somewhere in between. The thing is seriously lean the fuck over. It's going to fall one day. It has no choice. It has to. that it hasn't yet is remarkable. But now I kind of get an idea of why it hasn't happened yet. The compensation for the lien on that tree is this massive fucking root that is running from my neighbor's yard across my front yard diagonally, right? It's like from the front, his front sidewalk to my bedroom. I've got this root from hell that's growing across my front lawn. I mean, from hell. It's under fucking ground. But the size of it, it's bigger than my thigh. And it ain't even close. It's like much bigger than my thigh. It was actually exposed, right? I got the dead lawn that I talked about. The grass dried up. And I never noticed it before when I had the lush St. Augustine's grass growing over it. But there was an exposed little piece of root, little humpback, almost level with the dirt, but just a little higher. So you could see, there's a root there. And I already like kind of carved out the circle that I was going to use. You know, it's like a double circle, you got to imagine. Big, the outer perimeter of this circle is for containing mulch. Then the inner perimeter, an inner circle, is actually the hole in the ground where the tree goes in, right? When the tree shows up, I just drop the tree in there. Well, I'm clearing out the outer perimeter area, really the whole area, of all the dead grass. And I see this root sticking up there. And I see that it's going right through where I'm going to be laying down the edging that holds the mulch in. So I'm going to have to cut this root away in order to run that edging through flush, right? But I have no idea how big that root is until I start digging around it. I start digging around this fucking thing, you know, and it's like it's 18 inches down into the ground, and it's got shit going on underneath it that I can't see. It's all surrounded in, you know, Texas, North Texas, black dirt clay. And it wore out my battery-operated Sawzall battery twice, just trying to cut through it. I went to a manual approach, tried axe at it for a while, and then bust it with a sledgehammer. That wasn't getting me anywhere. I couldn't get up underneath it, like the bottom part. Like I said, it's 18 inches plus deep down. I couldn't get under it to cut all the way through it, to hack at it. I was getting nowhere. By that means, I had to get the chainsaw out, which I didn't want to do because I don't like cutting into the ground, especially this clay shit. Because you hit that, what's going to happen with the chain, right? So I'm out there busting my ass. I think about it, right? I've got an axe and a sledgehammer. I'm trying to cut the underside of a fucking root. So I'm going underground with the swing. And I'm bringing it all the way back from my ass bone on the full swing as hard as I can bring it down to cut as much as I can, to move as much as I can, to break as much as I can. Time and time again, getting nowhere. I am fucking busting it. I really am. I'm working hard out there only to, you know, have to break out the chainsaw and run that down and risk like hitting the clay. What happens when you hit the clay with the chainsaw chain? The chain derails. What happens when the chain derails? You lose a limb. You know, it slings up at you. It may come apart if it hits the wrong, the master key or the master link. Or it'll just fling the fuck off and it'll land on part of you somewhere. And I'm down there cutting it, and I'm keeping an eye on that shit, and lo and behold, you know, it took a while to actually cut through this, and, you know, the while is like I had to cut it once, then I had to cut it again to clear a whole section out so I could run that edging on the periphery, but then when I went to cut when I went to shovel out the hole where the tree gets planted, that same fucking root continued. And went right through there, too. As what I had plotted out was double fucked by this ginormous root from hell. So I had to cut it twice again to clear it out so I could plant a tree there. So I had to make these four cuts. And I got a 16-inch Poland chainsaw, which is just north of fucking garbage, right? I've done some decent stuff with it. But, you know, it's too short and it's not the great make. This thing struggled. This thing was struggling to cut these fucking roots out. And I felt like I was in danger. And finally it happened. You know, finally it happened. Finally, that fucking, that chain broke its track. You know, I hit fucking clay like I knew I would. And it jumped the track and it came slinging out at me. And I saw it and felt it. And I just naturally, instinctually just threw the entire chainsaw off to my right, away from my wife, away from everything, away, you know, just off the distance, away the immediate distance, away from everything. And I just stood there and she looked at me. She knew what happened. And she's mortified. She's got that look on her face, that sound in her voice. Are you okay? And I don't know. I don't know. I don't expect that I'll even feel a chainsaw chain cutting my fucking arm off. I don't, you know, I expect it's going to be kind of a clean cut. I won't know shit. If it just broke skin, I probably wouldn't even know it. I don't feel nothing. Am I bleeding? Do you see blood? And she didn't see no blood. And I start looking at myself, counting everything, all my digits. I look at my fucking hand. A big gash through the leather glove I was wearing, but it didn't catch my skin. It ripped the fucking leather open, but it didn't get my skin. Incredible. That close to disaster. The evil sycamore root and the chainsaw chain incident. All here in Texas, right? It's like my little mini version of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. You've heard of that one. Everybody's heard of that one. There's not even one anymore. There's a whole long line of prequels and sequels to that story. It's a movie, right? For those of you who don't know, and there's going to be one or two of you, I guess. Texas Chainsaw Massacre was a slasher horror film. It was released in 1974, you know, kind of one of those cult classics, as they say. Texas Chainsaw Massacre. It was filmed on location just outside of Austin, Texas. Outside of Round Rock, Texas, a bordering town to Austin down there, off of I-35. And, you know, back in 1974, it was all rural out there. They have their own situation with urban sprawl going on in Austin, just like it is in Dallas and Houston and San Antonio. And Round Rock is part of that sprawl. So all these, you know, the areas of land that they have available, been bought up and developed. And the property where the old farmhouse in Texas Chainsaw Massacre stood, that wasn't a set, that was an actual farmhouse on actual property, right? My understanding is the film was spearheaded, produced, directed, whatever, all the above, by a guy who was a film student at University of Texas in Austin over there, right? That's what Austin's built up around. Well, two things. The University of Texas and the state government, right? The state capital. So you had a student of UT, as we call it here, University of Texas. Not to be confused with University of Tennessee, which is in Knoxville, which lived over there also. UT film student put together this slasher movie and did it on a very low budget, and it turned out to be a cult classic. It was filmed on a location, on a couple of locations around Red Rock, Texas. Round Rock, Texas. But now they developed that area up. The developers actually purchased the grounds where the movie was filmed. So somebody, knowing that it was going to get wrecked down, so a neighborhood of McMansions can be raised up, decided that they were going to purchase the house and move it. And they did. They moved it from Round Rock, Texas to Kingsland, Texas, which is west of Round Rock, into the hill country, right? They moved the whole fucking house, the whole farmhouse that's in that movie, and they turned it into a restaurant is what they did. I looked into it. It's recently been renamed Hooper's Restaurant, and I think Hooper is the name of the guy who developed, produced, wrote, whatever, the student, the UT student, responsible for the entire Texas Chainsaw Massacre universe. I believe that's the story. I don't know. I've not been to the restaurant, but it is on my bucket list. I do want to go there. I read about it. It's Southern fare, chicken fried steak. So it's the kind of stuff that me and my wife will go out to the country. We'll go out to the country, and that's the kind of place we'll go to eat. And it's got the added ambiance of being the Texas Chainsaw Massacre house. Interesting. Hooper's Restaurant, Kingsland, Texas. We will go there someday. That's in the plans. What I didn't know, and this is the second instance of I didn't fucking know, where it regarded White Zombie, right? White Zombie, the, I guess you'd call it new metal band from the 90s, Rob Zombie, the driving force of that. Yeah, you'd call that new metal. I'd call that new metal. And it's got kind of the monster, kind of creeper, horror movie twist to it. Feel, but I mentioned in a previous episode where lyrics from a song, a White Zombie song, were harkening back to a science fiction movie. And here's another case where that's happened and I didn't realize it. And on the same album, too. Astro Creep 2000 is the name of the LP, released in 1995. And I had that one hot off the presses. I listened to that when I was working out in the gym with a couple of buddies of mine. We listened to that all the fucking time. That was one of my favorite. In fact, in those days, the song that I called, quote-unquote, my song, was on that album. It was the other song I'm making reference to, More Human Than Human. Went back to the sci-fi movie Blade Runner, right? There's a connection between the song and the movie in that case, which I didn't know that. I didn't know that at the time. And this I didn't know either, because there's a song on Astro Creep 2000, White Zombie album from 95, called Real Solution Number 9. Real Solution Number 9. That's a twist on the Beatles. I guess it's the White album, or they at the Revolution Number 9. You go Number 9, Number 9, Number 9. Right, we used to listen to that when we were tripping and be like, oh, what the fuck is Number 9, dude? I know somebody out there knows. I don't really even care. But this, you know, Real Solution Number 9, Revolution Number 9. There's a connection to that. I'm not making this shit up. But there's a lyric in the song Real Solution Number 9 that's repeated throughout the duration of the song. It goes, who will survive and what will be left of them? Who will survive and what will be left of them? What I didn't know about that was that is, that lyric is actually text from the movie poster for the original Texas Chainsaw Massacre. On the poster, it said, who will survive and what will be left of them? And then under it said, Texas Chainsaw Massacre. So Rob Zombie took made lyrics out of the text on a movie poster from Texas Chainsaw Massacre, right? And there's a lot of sampling that's taken also from an interview of one of Manson's family, Charles Manson's family members. So to get reference to the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the Manson murders in this one song. And that's the kind of stuff you get with Rob Zombie, right? Obviously, a lot of his creativity is inspired by sci-fi and horror and actual real tales of horror in this world. It ends up in his music. And because of that, I get this impression of this guy that he's probably kind of twisted and demented and weird. And I've spoken before at some length periodically about how I feel about musicians who I get too familiar with, right? I start to like learn their biography, their life story. I see interviews with them, and the ones that are more outspoken about their politics and religion and things like that, I start to get a distaste for, right? And the music loses its luster to me when I know the intent, you know, what the artist's inspiration was, all this kind of stuff. And Rob Zombie, I never really ran into any kind of interview with him or article about him, book or biography about him. I don't know shit about the guy, really. I generally know that White Zombie came into its existence playing in and around New York City. I think I had an idea that he came from Massachusetts somewhere. And like I said earlier, I get the impression he's probably some kind of weirdo, some kind of creepy fucking just peculiar dude. And well, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I just stumbled on it. You know, I was kind of just scrolling through my YouTube homepage where they throw shit up at you that you kind of might be interested in because you looked at something else. And there was the Joe Rogan podcast, right? The very famous Joe Rogan podcast where he's interviewing Rob Zombie. I thought, you know what? I'm going to look at that. And I did. I watched it for about a half hour, 45 minutes. I didn't even finish it. But I was very impressed with Rob Zombie. Very articulate person. Not what you would think at all. Very down-to-earth dude. He's the kind of guy I could hang around with, you know? Or so it seemed. I was impressed with him. Obviously a creative genius. But he does not seem to be a fucking weirdo. So I think I had that guy all wrong. Interestingly enough, I didn't go bother to learn more about him because I'll probably find out something that I don't like that's going to ruin the music for me. I'll just let it go. Just let it go there. So yeah, he's a cooler dude than I thought. And his music is cool, so roll with it. This podcast was dated September of 2019, right? September 2019. Another thing I found online involving Rob Zombie was a Rolling Stone article written by Rob Zombie that was really attesting to the artistic quality of Texas Chainsaw Massacre and the producer, director, basic overall creator, the Hooper guy I mentioned earlier, Toby Hooper. So Rob Zombie, a big fan, actually wrote an article. He penned an article in 2017 that appeared in a Rolling Stone magazine. And the point, I guess, well, I'm not guessing. The point was that the Texas Chainsaw Massacre was more than gore. It was, you know, it was not just a slasher shock movie in horror, that there was actual like artistry in the story and everything else, the cinematography and the dramatics. There was, you watched the movie and you could see the allegory, right? There's, you know, in keeping with the times as they were, we're going back to the early 70s and even to the modern day. I mean, mainstream Hollywood, mainstream cinematic productions are far and wide a community of left-leaning people, right? And a lot of the allegorical expression in the stories and movies is going to be points that involve these leftist ideas, these leftist mindsets. And, you know, back in the 70s, that kind of artistic expression, in most cases, seemed to be very contrived, you know? It didn't seem ever to organically come to that end, but rather that was the intent from the beginning. You know, writing with the intent, you know, creative writing with the intent of carrying some kind of secondary message, right? So much of this art, especially this leftist type of art, has that hidden message, which goes with my idea of everything left is kind of given to being hidden in the dark, that you have to go through like a puzzle and put it all together, right? It can't just be straightforward. It can't just stand in the light. And I don't mean to go off on that tangent, but, you know, watching that movie and so many other movies, especially from that time period where it was so fucking contrived. What do I mean by contrived? Just like I said, you know, the great example of contrived leftist ideology expressed in theatrics was all those Norman Lear sitcoms that I've bitched about. And other episodes, right? All in the Family and One Day at a Time and a whole fucking litany of them, right? But their episodes all had this contrived message. You know, the whole story was built to this one point, and it was always some kind of expression of leftist ideology. Whatever, you know. The article that I mentioned that Rob Zombie wrote wasn't going into that kind of detail about it all, right? This is just me watching that movie and recognizing, you know, seeing what I'm looking at. It was just all right there, kind of pretty evident, you know, pretty evident. I'll give you an example, all right? Just like in the real, probably largest contextual parameters of Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the original movie from 1974, the way it was laid out. The basic context is urban people going out into rural country, right? And you are following along with the urban people as if they're your friends, they're your buddies, and you're doing things that they were doing. They were basically hippies in a van, you know, or some college kids in a van that were hippie-ish, because the times were hippie-ish, right? Early 70s. So you're taken on a ride, and you're part of their crew. You're one of them now, and you're going out into rural Texas, and you're encountering these weird and violent and gruesome, horrible people. Right, that is like the widest, grandest context of the story right there. And then you get all the subcontext that goes within those parameters. So you have this basic vilification of all things that are rural, right? The first character that they encounter is this weird guy who's coming home from the slaughterhouse, who was brother of the Leatherface, right? The little brother of the Leatherface, and you know, he cuts himself with a knife, he cuts another guy with a knife, and he's just weird and ugly and gruesome and unpredictable. And this is the idea. You leave the city and you go out in the country, and this is the kind of what you're going to find out there, right? That's that basic vilification of all things rural. And as your grand context for this horror story. So, but Rob Zombie, highly influenced by that and other works of this guy, Toby Hooper. He did a bunch of other things too. That's his basic career through his life. And I'll be honest with you, I don't know much about all that. I've probably seen a few of the movies along the way, but I've never really had any personal regard for him as a creative mind. I never even really knew the name. I knew the movie, you know, and whatever movies I saw, I knew, but I never looked at it like a line of Toby Hooper movies. I missed the boat on that one. But again, I'm not the greatest horror fan in the world either. Maybe there's more to see in all that, and I should probably look at it a little bit more. We'll see. We'll see. But yeah, Rob Zombie, highly influenced by that particular work. You know, like I said, Texas Chainsaw Massacre ends up in his lyrics, like so many other sci-fi and horror movies do. You know, I said that I didn't really know, like, the Rob Zombie biography. I don't know his backstory and everything like that. And so I decided to look at it, and I think I'm going to read a little bit. I'm talking about this guy, and I don't mean to, like, put him up on any kind of pedestal at all. But, you know, I really don't know. I think the point that I was trying to make is I know what I know through the music, and even through the music, I don't know what his inspirations and all these pop culture references that he brings into his songs until I go looking and find out, right? Or if I happen to recognize one of those references, whichever the case may be. But I always just like the music, and well, like our minds are apt to do, I've made assumptions about the person based on what I was hearing, and then based on the presentation, like album covers and MTV videos and shit like that, right? And I, you know, I found that there was a lot more to this person that meets the eye, for certain, you know, for certain. So I was like, all right, let's find out a little bit about this guy. Hopefully it's not too much. You know, what I want to do is put a basic background up there, because there are things about him I didn't know that are kind of fascinating, right? I'm going to just read something I found online here. A mini biography, right? Robert Bartla Cummings, more famously known as Rob Zombie, was born in Haverhill, Massachusetts on January 12th, 1965. He is the oldest son of Louise and Robert Cummings, and has a younger brother, Michael David, also known as Spider One, who was born in 1968, and is also the lead singer of Power Man 5000. See, I didn't know any of that shit. Growing up, Zombie loved horror movies, go figure, which have greatly influenced his music and filmmaking career. In 1983, he graduated from Haverhill High School. After graduating, he moved to New York City to attend Parsons School of Design, and briefly working as a production assistant on Pee-wee's Playhouse. That's Pee-wee Herman. Rob Zombie was on Pee-wee Herman, as a production worker in the background. And then it goes on, you know, him and his girlfriend co-founded a band they called White Zombie, named after the Bela Lugosi classic horror film of the same name from 1932. They released their debut album, a bunch of EPs, they got discovered, and then all of a sudden they, you know, became famous a couple years later. So, like, that's the backstory. Other stuff that I saw in his backstory that's not mentioned here is that he grew up in a carnival family, right? I think as his mother's side, they, like, were carnival people, and he was doing that as a kid growing up. And here's a correction, all right? Somebody told me he was a short dude, and actually it says his height here is 5'10". It ain't exactly tall, but it ain't exactly short either. It's kind of middling height, so he's not a little guy like people have expressed to me. Had that wrong, and I stand corrected. My bad. There's going to be corrections from time to time. I just happened to notice that going through. But yeah, he grew up like in a carnival atmosphere. That makes for kind of a fascinating story. So that's a little bit about Rob Zombie, and that's about as far as I really want to know. I want to keep it to the music, you know. I understand that he's a creative genius now. He's not a walking freak show. He's a human being, and I like a lot of work that he's done. You know, but he's Zombie now. Obviously, his name was not Zombie at birth. He took that name on, and I read where it's actually his legal name as of 1996. But he was not born into this world as Rob Zombie. I wonder why he chose Zombie, if there's like real deep meaningful substance to it, but I found nothing. I look at what a zombie is by dictionary definition, because I'm apt to pull out the dictionary on this podcast, right? A zombie is a person, usually undead, animated by what they're saying, unnatural forces, in parentheses, such as magic, with no soul or will of his or her own, right? So a person, usually undead, animated by unnatural forces, with no soul or will of his or her own. Now, I'll just simplify that. An undead being that is animated by supernatural forces. And I'm not sure about the with the soul or with no soul or with no will, but that's how they're defining it there. I could get into that a little bit more. I mentioned, you know, in that biography about the white zombie movie, the Bela Lugosi white zombie movie. I do not know whether I've seen that one or not. I kind of think that I did back in the 90s, but I just cannot remember. 1932, white zombie movie. That's what the white zombie band was named after. And, yeah, that's one of... Well, actually, it's like the granddaddy of zombie movies. It's like the first in line of all the zombie movies that came out. It's known to be the very first one of all zombie movies. And then there was the first one in the... modern sense. It's also the biggest, most popular, most highly regarded, The Night of the Living Dead, which came out in 68, right? And I don't know what they mean when they say modern sense. It's done in color. You know, some other kind of technology brings it into the modern era. 1968 is a long fucking time ago, let me tell you. That's like most of my life ago, and I'm an old dude, right? I would think that there's something even more modern still, but that's how it's regarded. You got the original zombie movie, and then you've got like the first of the modern zombie movies. Night of the Living Dead was huge. That's 1968, like I told you. Other zombie things, the zombies, you know, back to the 60s, right? There was a band out of England called The Zombies. The Zombies. And I'm familiar with The Zombies. In fact, I have a song downloaded on my phone by The Zombies. There's a bunch of, 60s pre-psychedelic music that I like. A lot of the, what do you call that shit? The British Invasion music. No, I don't like all of it. I don't take like a whole band and love every song. There's like certain songs by certain bands in certain years that strike me. And the Zombies are like that, you know. And they've got like 2-3 popular songs through their short history through the 60s. And the first one was She's Not There, famously redone by Santana later on. She's Not There. That's the song I have on my phone. I've always loved that song. They played it on the radio when I was a kid, you know, like in junior high. And I hear that, and I was just like, who the fuck is that, you know? I'd find out who it was, and you know, back then, you couldn't find it on an album or anything like that, so I never heard it unless it came on the radio, so it was like a real special song. The world ain't that way now. Everything, you want it, you got it, on a whim, you know? Anything, anytime, all the time. And so it's like I never really developed a great following. I just couldn't find nothing by them to have and to hold and to own. They weren't the hugest band of that era. You know, the larger bands had things in print that you could buy. But I could find nothing from them back then. I had no albums that had Zombies music on it as a kid growing up. Just strictly on the radio. Now, the guy who's kind of like the leader of the band, he moved on to a solo career into the 70s. They named the band after himself, called Argent, right? Argent. And they had one song that got a lot of airplay. I'm familiar with, right? Hold Your Head Up. Hold your head up. Hold your head up. A lot of airplay, but always on the radio, you know, always on the radio. I know the song. I didn't really know the back history. I didn't know Argent. I didn't know the connection to the Zombies. This stuff I just kind of found out lately. But there's some Zombies stuff for you. More Zombies stuff. Here we go. Bring it back to reel it back in. Post Arlen, Texas, right? Keep this Texas thing. Reverend Horton Heat, right? The one and only Reverend Horton Heat on his 2014 Rev LP, R-E-V, short for Reverend, right? Or Rev 'em Up, depending on how you want to look at it. 2014 Rev LP, which Jim Heath signed the CD cover for me. I got somewhere I have, I expect, a signed CD cover by the Reverend Horton Heat of that particular LP, Rev. On that LP, why I bring all that up, is a song called Zombie Dumb. And that's it. That's the lyrics of the song right there. It has this like wild kind of 60s surfer feel to it with some kind of jungle fucking drums. And it just goes through, I don't know, a certain amount of measures of that music. And then it comes to a pause. And then Jim Heath just goes into the microphone. Zombie Dumb. And, you know, I think the idea of the song Zombie Dumb, and I have no idea what Jim Heath had in mind when he was writing it. I'm not trying to say that I know what he was pointing it at. But when I hear that, I'm thinking of the younger generations of people who are walking around with their smartphones. And when I say walking around, I mean literally walking around. As they walk from point A to point B, they've got their phones down at their bellies and their heads down looking at the phone, and they're not paying attention to what they're walking towards. So they're just kind of drifting around, oblivious. Completely tuned into whatever it is they're focused on their little mini handheld computer, and with no regard, or I should say little to no regard, of any of the events that are occurring around them. Talk about a lack of presence. Talk about not being present. And it is as if they are zombies. And that's how we refer to people like that. It is zombies, cell phone zombies, smartphone zombies. And that's not a new thing. That's not like a recent phenomenon. It's been this way for fucking 20 years. You know, I think from the moment a child got a cell phone, it became attached to him like a pecker. Young people are in absolute awe of these things. Older generation from us, we had to go through the whole development from the mainframe computers to the mini computers, desktops, and all that, and then all the different iterations of that, and then all of a sudden there was email and internet and networking, and you know, and we've just seen it all come along. And I recognize this smartphone as just another iteration of personal computing, right? And I do what I do on it. And I do spend a lot of time on mine. It's not to say that they ain't a worthwhile and viable tool for living. But I do what I do. And then when I'm done, I shut it off and I put it in my pocket and I go and live. I intend to be as present as I can possibly be. In fact, even when I have it on, I'm more alert of what's going on around me than I am of what I'm looking at or reading, you know? Unless I'm engaged with it, like, there's a couple little video games I'll play to pass time, for example. But even those, I could just stop in the middle of whatever I'm doing and drop it and get real, right? I'm not about a diversion from reality. I may be passing time, not looking for diversions here. But like, speaking of video games and zombies, right? I remember because I had a brood of stepsons at one point in my life, and they were all about video games, you know, the Xbox this and the PlayStation that. We're going back 10, 12, 13, 14 years, somewhere in that period of time. And the boys would sit around and they were playing Call of Duty. Modern Warfare, Call of Duty World at War, Call of Duty Black Ops and Black Ops 2. These are the ones I remember having in the house. Like every time the new one came out, it's like that was the gift that every kid had to have for Christmas, you know? And these boys had them all. And I played them a little. I watched them play, and then I would play a little. I like those kind of games, those first-person shoot 'em up types and the military types. In fact, I played them extensively, one particular one extensively, for years prior to that. Online, on a squad, all that, running a squad even. I was very involved, you know, way more than a man should ever be. But it was a different one. It was, and I talked about this before, it was the Novalogic Delta Force series, where the worlds were wide open. You could just go and go and go, you know. Call of Duty was kind of more a tighter framework. Your maps were smaller. And, the action was good, but it's really close up and personal action. I like to vary it. I like to do that, and then I like to go out in the hills and snipe and, you know. So it wasn't my perfect cup of tea. And I don't play console games generally anyhow. I was always on the PC, right? Putting my hours in on the computer. Even though the console's a computer also of a sort. That's mostly an entertainment box. Games and movies, you know. Mostly. They've probably come a long way since in the past 10 years. I haven't even looked at one of them, but whatever. That's not the point of any of this. The point is that three or four of those Call of Duties, they were running some kind of like zombie-related missions in them, right? There was like some kind of zombie train or something. My memory of it is a little bit thin. You know, it's a little bit vague. It's been a long time, and it was never really anything... a serious focal point of my life. But there was that. And because of the popular Call of Duty, right? And I don't mean to belittle it in any way. It just, I guess by the time I met up with Call of Duty, I was pretty much done with that stuff. Just done with video games in general. Like not pursuing the next greatest thing out, you know? Not involving myself in a multiplayer community. None of that. Like I said, I play to pass time. I got 5 minutes to burn if I'm sitting, like, getting my oil changed somewhere. And I've done read up on everything I need to read up on. I've answered all the texts and emails. And I still got 5 minutes to burn. I'll throw on some old video game that I have on the phone. It's nothing to it. Pastime. It's not an involvement. It's nothing. It's not a hobby. It's nothing. It's literally throwaway fucking garbage time for me. But yeah, but Call of Duty, wildly popular. Perhaps the most popular series of video games ever made. I don't really know. I don't keep those statistics. I don't keep company with people who do. I don't really know. But just Now, I think of some of the most popular games ever. I go back to Doom, right? The original Doom. World of Warcraft. I never played that, but that was wildly popular. May still be. I don't know. Call of Duty. Wildly popular. What else was wildly popular? A lot of popular video games, but which ones were crazy, like culturally impacting? See, that's what I'm getting to with the Call of Duty. It had an impact on culture. All of a sudden, you know, we became a society of, like, zombie hunters. I'd start seeing, like, bumper stickers, and I don't necessarily know what they mean or what they come from, you know? Where'd this whole idea, like, hunting zombies come from? I go to the gun range, and, you know, they have their... They'll give you a couple of targets when you come in and you pay your fee for the afternoon. You bring some from home, or if you want some fancy ones with the fluorescence that shine back at you, you know, show you where you're... Your round hit, you could spend more money. And then they had like the zombie targets that are like that. You know, they're expensive ones, but they have like a picture of a zombie on it. What is with this whole fucking zombie thing? But it started right around that time. So I equate it directly with Call of Duty. When, you know, I think every house that had kids had Call of Duty, and they had a father in there who played it with them, who probably played it more than the kids did. And now this whole, like, zombie hunting thing became a part of our culture. And it really hasn't died. I still see that when I go to the gun range, you know. Every here and there. Somebody will abandon their, you know, their last target, and they'll just leave it there and go. There's a fucking zombie. They're still doing this shit. All these years later, right? Why do I even bother to bring that up, right? No, I wonder about it. I wonder. I used that word, the words earlier, organically developed stories. You know, you write a story, and then, like, the next consequential thing occurs, which leads to the next consequential thing, and then in retrospect, you may see a pattern that of a sub story or allegory having had developed. Seemingly on its own, without being contrived, right? And that was the other word, organic or contrived. I use that about, you know, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre and those Norman Lear sitcoms earlier. But what about the whole social phenomenon that zombies became like 10 years ago? The 2010s, basically, right? What the hell? Was that organic? Did that just happen? Did somebody decide that they're going to put zombies in a video game, and the video game became so popular, now we became a world of zombie hunters? At the same time, the zombie hunter was the zombie, right? Because that zombie hunter is the kid with the phone walking around with a total lack of presence. It became a zombie world. Did that just happen organically, or was that maybe contrived? Is that nefarious? Was that something sinister? Was that something that the powers that be injected into our culture to prepare us?
Thank you for tuning into Post-Stalin Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Stalin Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at poststalin.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@poststalin.com.